Hello, everyone. This is Betsy Wurzel, your host of Chatting with Betsy on Passion World Talk Radio Network, a subsidiary of Global Media Network, LLC. Our mantra is to educate, enlighten, and entertain. The views of the guest may not represent those of the host of the station. Folks, this show in particular, I am going to do a disclaimer that if you have any mental health issues that you're concerned about, if you take SSRIs that we will be discussing, please consult your physician whose care you are under. Do not stop taking any medication. Always, always consult your doctor, whether it's your primary care doctor, if you're under care of a psychiatrist, whoever you're under the care under, please consult them. Also, this show I recommend for adults 18 and above due to the subject matter. I wanted to say that. It's not for young children. It's for adult ears. And with saying that, I want to just say, as you all know, I'm a mental health advocate. It is still May. It's still Mental Health Awareness Month. And the name of the book, I'm going to just say the name of the book first, and I'm going to tell you about the author. The name of the book is Medication, Mental Illness, and Murder, What Really Killed the Crespi Twins by Edward L. Jones III. Now, before you say, oh, that sounds depressing. Oh, I don't think I want to hear that. You're going to want to hear this. This is a story I did not know about myself. And I'm so glad I read the book. And I just want to say kudos to Ed Jones for being brave enough to tackle this matter, to write this book, to address mental health care issues, the criminal justice system, and what's going on. And I am, as you know, very passionate about mental health care issues. And I want to tell you about Edward L. Jones III now. Ed has been an award-winning writer in advertising and higher education. During his ad career, he won more than 350 awards for creativity. In his time away from advertising, Ed served as a community columnist for the Charlotte Observer. He lives in Winston-Salem, North Carolina area. This is his first book, and I'll tell you, folks, for a first book, and I'm by no means have credentials to be a book critic, for a first book, incredible. I want to see Ed Jones be a best international seller. This book needs to be told around the world. People need to read it. I want to welcome Ed Jones to Chatting with Betsy. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you, Betsy. Your words are most kind. I really appreciate them. Thank you.
Oh, you are welcome. I have to tell you, Ed, this book deeply touched me on so many levels for so many different reasons. And being that I am a mental health care advocate, I was kind of like, I don't know about this book, to be honest. And when I started reading it, I was like, oh, my goodness. I never heard of the Crespi situation. The trial. I never watched the Oprah Winfrey Show. I saw clips of it now after I read your book, or as I was reading your book. And my heart just goes out to the Crespi family. I mean, this is a travesty is an understatement. Could you tell us how you came upon the story and what motivated you to write this book? And again, kudos to you for doing it. I applaud you.
Thanks so much. Yes, I didn't go looking for this story. It kind of came looking for me. And what I mean by that is, in November of 2005, my wife and I were just getting to know David and Kim Crespi, around December of the same year, 2005, right around Christmas time, Ann, who had befriended Kim Crespi more than I had befriended David, Ann told me that Kim had told her that David was suffering from a really bad bout of depression right there around Christmas time. And my heart immediately went out to him because by that time I had fought my way through three bouts of clinical depression. All of those bouts happened before the advent of SSRI antidepressants, probably between 1974 and 81. So I was able to successfully fight those off and have been successful ever since. But, you know, I told my wife to tell Kim Crespi, to tell David that if he needed somebody to talk to, I would be there yesterday because, you know, if any of your listeners have experienced depression, they know that depression is agony on every level, mentally, spiritually, even physically, you know. So, you know, I said, I really feel for David, what he's going through. I'll be there for him, you know, in a millisecond. Well, we got word from Kim that David had experienced previous episodes of depression and that she and David felt like he was getting the best clinical care that he ever had. And so we breathed a sigh of relief and thought everything was going to be okay. And then, you know, gosh, 3-4 weeks later, on January 20th, 2006, we received a phone call from a friend named Teresa, called my wife, and I think Teresa almost sort of said, "Are you sitting down?" And she's a very religious person, but she said to my wife, you know Dave Crespi?" And my wife says, yeah, I know Dave. Dave just did away with his twin daughters, Samantha, 5-year-old twin daughters. And of course we almost fainted hearing that news. And you know, I almost had a form of survivor guilt there for a while after we heard about that. But so what happened was on the morning of or like around the mid afternoon of January 20th, 2006, David was home on medical leave. He's a very successful banker, an exemplary husband and father, no history of violence, but he was at home on medical leave, and he was with Kim and the two twin girls, 5-year-old twin girls. The other three children were away at school. So when Kim went out to get a haircut at about 12:05, the little girls came over to David, who was on his computer, and asked if he would like to play a game of hide-and-seek. And I'm not going to go into all the horrific details, but he ended up finding them and stabbing them both to death. And then he called 911 after he'd washed up. He calls 911, and the first thing he says is, I just killed my two daughters. And you hear the 911 operator say, "You just what? I just killed my two daughters," in this kind of weirdly measured tone. And then a female 911 operator cuts in and says, "Sir, are you on any medication?" He says, "Yes." "What kind of medication?" "I'm on antidepressants." Later she says, "We're just worried that you've taken too many medications and, you know, and that you're disoriented." And he says, no, this is real. And so one of the interesting things about that is that the transcript of that 911 tape and the recording of that 911 tape was not released to the press nor to the public until almost 3 months after David Crespi was sentenced to two consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole. So as you can imagine, I've I followed, you know, after the tragedy, I followed the reporting in the Charlotte Observer, and as you said, I was a community columnist for them for a while, and what came out was that David was on a cocktail of different drugs, prescribed drugs, Ambien, Trazodone, and he had just started Prozac 7 days before the killings. And it later came out that he was also on clarithromycin, which is, my doctor told me it's combining clarithromycin and Prozac is a particularly explosive combination. But anyway, so it kind of went from there. I went to a Superior Court hearing, and that's in the book. Maybe we can talk about that. I've gone on too long, probably. Sorry.
No, I'm not. Don't be sorry, please. You know what? I'm going to start from David Crespi's first marriage, because I think it's important, Ed. I want to bring this out. David Crespi was married to another Kim, right?
That's right.
And his first wife had brain cancer, I remember from the book. And unfortunately, she died, and he had two children with her. Is that correct?
Am I remembering correctly?
Right. Now, I just want to say right then, right here and now, I'd interviewed male caregivers. I am in the caregiving community. Watching your loved one die will make you depressed. And unfortunately, Ed, as you know, in our society, and I hope this changes, I'm doing my part to help change it by having my show, men are told to suck it up, be strong, which is a bunch of nonsense. People, stop telling people to be strong. I can't even stand that. and that needs to change. I could do a whole show on that. I'm not going to do that. I just want to say that I believe, in my own opinion, that David probably started then, unless he had depression before, because he probably felt, I can imagine from what I hear from other male caregivers, as a man, you think you could fix it. You should have fixed it. You could have made it better. There's things you can't make better in life, unfortunately. Then having to deal with the grieving and having two young children, I can't even imagine. I mean, I lost my spouse. I know what that's like. But to have young children, and I know that when my husband was dying, people had the audacity to tell my son and I, be strong. That's so, that just, it's not a proper thing to say, folks, because people are strong, and men are strong, but just because someone cries and seeks mental health support does not make them weak.
That's right.
And I'm very strong about that. I get very emotional about that, Ed, because it just is so wrong, the stigma and what society places on men and young boys. And I hope that changes. We need to have an environment where boys can voice their feelings in a constructive manner. But I digress. I wanted to bring that out.
That's a great point. Yes, I've heard various theories about what can cause depression, and I've heard kind of suppressing anger can be an element. I think you're right. Grieving can plant the seeds. And I think part of grieving is anger about what's happened to a loved one, you know. And so, I'm behind you 100% of what you just said.
Yes, and if David didn't get counseling, because how could he with his job and taking care of two children, plus it's frowned upon, you get depressed. I mean, let's face it, who wouldn't be depressed when their spouse dies? Everyone is.
Yeah.
And grieving actually you know, does change your brain. It's called the grieving brain. But I just wanted to address that because as soon as I read that in this book, in your book, Ed, I was thinking this poor man probably started then. Probably when his wife got diagnosed, actually, and just a course. Because David Crespi, as you said, was a great father. He started a scholarship in honor of his first wife, a nursing scholarship.
That's right.
He was very successful in his field. What was his job again?
Yeah.
That would have to do with the bank. Bank, something with the financial.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned this time frame. So by the time he was 29, he was the CFO of Sacramento Savings Bank. He was the youngest CFO in the history of that savings bank, which had a, I think it was 100 years old or so. And, you know, he went to an arm of the University of California there in Sacramento, had a perfect 4.0 grade point average. And then when he took the CPA exam, he scored in the top five in the country that year. So he was quite a star in the financial world. By the time he got to Charlotte, where these horrible events happened, he was working for Wachovia, which has been renamed, swallowed up. But he was in charge of compliance there. And that was one of the stressors that was going on at the time of the tragedy.
I know, Ed, that with medications, and I know this for a fact from my own personal experience. I wasn't on antidepressants, but I know that in taking medication, some people are very sensitive. I'm very sensitive to medication. There's a side effect to be had. I'll get it. But a lot of these SSRIs and some of these antidepressants, they are black boxed. Now, I know David was a young man, but they are black boxed for those that are 65 and older.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you have side effects, you call up your doctor a lot or talk to them in person, a lot of times they don't believe you. I mean, that's a whole other show in of itself also. I just want to tell people, you got to be your own advocate. You have to, if you see your loved one who can't speak up for themselves or you yourself, your children, are having side effects, call them up and insist that they listen to you because they kind of shoo-shoo you off. And have your proof, do your research, and be your advocate. I digress.
Amen.
I get off on these tangents.
No, that's right. Just to add to what you're saying about the importance of that and being aware of side effects, you know, the first two sentences in my prologue are these. This is a true story about a terrible family tragedy, a tragedy made more terrible by how preventable it was. What do I mean by that? 15 hours before David Crespi killed his utterly innocent, defenseless little girls, he and his entire family was playing a board game in their kitchen, and that included the twins. They were playing the game with everybody, and the whole family noticed this odd behavior. He was walking, that very spacious house, he was walking strangely, erratically around the various rooms in the house, into the library, into the dining room, into the living room, and then coming back and then doing the whole circuit again. And then Kim said that later that evening he was erratically jumping in and out of their bed And she recently told me that they had this square rug beside their bed, and he was doing this strange thing of going from, you know, almost obsessively going from corner to corner to corner of that rug. And what that was that was a, that should have been a glaring, it should have been like alarm bell should have been going off, because what David was evincing was a side effect called akathisia. Akathisia is a Greek word which basically means the inability to sit still. And what it signals is that the body, the brain is going into toxicity, and that the person experiencing that is in grave danger of harming himself or others. And if the Crespi family had known about that, those little girls would still be alive today. Why did they not know that? Because for decades, the big pharmaceutical companies that make this, that make these drugs, suppressed clinical trial data that showed this side effect in a significant number of trial patients. And here's an example that just that drives me crazy. So Prozac was introduced, and that was the first SSRI antidepressant introduced to the world, really, in America. But that was 1987. Now here is, and of course, all these companies were sort of doing these clinical trials in the run-up to when they finally marketed these various SSRI antidepressants. This involves Zoloft and Pfizer. So check this out. In 1983, this is 4 years before any SSRI was approved for the market in the U.S., in 1983, 9 years before the launch of Zoloft in the United States, 21 years before the FDA required Pfizer to put a black box warning on it, Pfizer had done a healthy volunteer trial on Zoloft in the United Kingdom. They recruited 12 women for this trial. Half of them were to be given Zoloft. The other half were given a placebo. The trial was due to run for 2 weeks, but it was stopped after 1 week because every single woman taking Zoloft had become anxious, apprehensive, agitated. In other words, showing signs of akathisia. One or two had begun to voice thoughts about harming others. These were previously healthy women. One or two had begun to voice thoughts about harming others. All of the other things that led the FDA to put a black box warning on this drug 21 years later were there in 1983.
Wow.
But what did Pfizer do? They buried all of that. But there's a wonderful doctor named Dr. David Healy, whose work I cite in the book, who was able to get hold of all that data and dig into it and find out these things.
That just is mind-boggling. And, you know, in your book, you also have, like, little side stories of people who were on various medications who did violent acts. And now when I hear about a violent act, I wonder, oh, were they on something? That's the first thing I ask, because, you know, when you hear these commercials for these various medications and you're like, well, who the heck wants to take it? If you already are depressed, maybe you could be suicidal, and then it could make you have more ideation of suicide. I mean, I'm glad I never took a medication, and I didn't take that. But can you tell the audience, what is a SSRI?
Yes. So SSRI, SSRI is an acronym for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor. And those drugs are based on a theory that if through these drugs you elevate the level of a neurotransmitter called serotonin in the brain, if you kind of elevate the presence of that in the brain, somehow that is a silver bullet to basically cure depression in a way, you know. And at first that probably seemed like a good theory, because you know, as I reveal in the book, the first generation of antidepressants came about by accident. A group of chemists set out in about 1955 or so to try to find a chemical compound that was capable of wiping out the bacterium associated with tuberculosis. So they finally found what they thought was something that could do that. And ironically, it was stockpiled Nazi rocket fuel, fuel that had been used to propel Nazi rockets in World War II. So,
that sounds gross to take.
Yeah. Well, so what happened was, so they brought these chemicals back to a lab in New Jersey, and they derived a couple of different molecules or chemical compounds. One of them was called like a prionazid. I think this is in the book. It's in a chapter called A History of Antidepressants. So they tested what they thought was going to be a cure for tuberculosis on some patients who were in a hospital sanatorium or whatever in Staten Island. And what they found was, the patients were still coughing up blood, but some of them were coming out into the corridors and sort of dancing, you know. And so they seemed happier than ever before, as they were dying from their tuberculosis. Well, so what happened was the scientists had this theory that that led to monoamine, the first generation of antidepressants, monoamine inhibitors, and at that time they thought the three neurotransmitters that were helping to solve depression were dopamine, serotonin, and one other, neonephrine or something like that. Sorry about, I don't have that right in front
of me. That's okay. That's all right.
But that first generation of, you know, the monoamine inhibitors ended up having terrible side effects, you know, terrible liver damage, causing hypertension. And so what happened was there was a group of chemists associated with Eli Lilly that went ahead and they based the future drugs on, it's got to be serotonin that we need to isolate on, and maybe that will, eliminate these physical side effects. And so that's kind of a long-winded thing, but that's how it all came about.
Well, I know a friend that I went to high school with, her daughter, I had asked her, after reading your book, I asked her what medications her daughter was on, and she wasn't sure. She knew she took Ambien, and unfortunately, her daughter committed suicide.
Oh, how horrible.
And, yes, and I talked to my psychologist about your book, Ed, and about akathisia. Mm-hmm. Is that how you pronounce it? And
akathisia, yes.
Akathisia. And he said, yes. He says, you have to watch someone for that. When someone goes on medication, you can't just say, okay, see you in 4 weeks. They have to be monitored. Was David Crespi monitored weekly by his doctor, do you know?
He was. You know, the day before the killings, he had been in a session with Kim right there with his therapist. Yes. And you know, you mentioned the Oprah Winfrey show. You know, Ms. Winfrey really seized on the fact that David later admitted he was having these dark thoughts, but that in that session the day before the killings, he didn't share those dark, intrusive thoughts about harming his family. And you know, that was kind of Ms. Winfrey's premise about, like, you know, she comes at the end of the hour-long show, she says, you know, here's the lesson of all this. If he had just, you know, shared his dark thoughts, those two little girls, they could have changed the medication, quote unquote, and those two little girls might be alive today. And I would like to, if I could,
sure,
talk about, yeah, you mentioned some other cases from around the world, and this is one I think it's important for listeners to hear about. So this occurred in Australia, here's how this story goes. On August the 1st, 1999, 74-year-old Australian David Hawkins, another David, a model citizen with no prior history of violence, attacked his 68-year-old wife, strangling her to death. He immediately called Australia's equivalent of 911, and the call was recorded. Here's the first thing he said. I have killed my wife. How eerily similar does that sound? I got tablets from the doctor yesterday, and I think they were too strong. I went absolutely wild. I don't know. I have got to go. I'm heading out, and I'm going to get rid of myself. Nobody can help me now. I'm shaking here. I can't wait. I can't stop. So the tablets, quote-unquote tablets David Hawkins had taken were Zoloft. When he hung up, Hawkins attempted to asphyxiate himself with carbon monoxide from his car. He stopped because he was worried about the effect that two deaths would have on his daughter. Hawkins was charged with murder. At the trial, the judge accepted a defense of automatism, meaning that Hawkins wasn't responsible for his actions. Here's what the Supreme Court judge of this Australian court said, quote, but for the Zoloft, which he took on the morning of August the 1st, 1999, it is overwhelmingly probable that Mrs. Hawkins would not have been killed on that morning. Okay, so this last part is germane to what we were just talking about before this. The Supreme Court quoted, quote, evidence from the Department of Health and Aged Care of 510 Australian patients on Zoloft who reacted badly, wrote a couple of reporters. The world's leading expert of Zoloft, Dr. David Healy of the University of Wales College of Medicine, claims the 510 figure is undoubtedly wrong and that between 5,100 and 51,000 patients affected adversely would be realistic. The truth, he says, can never be known. This is very important about the Crespi case, too. The truth, he says, can never be known because patients keep their feelings to themselves,
mm-hmm,
fearing what will happen if they reveal murderous thoughts. He's saying this in 1999, 8 years before the Crespi, or 7 years before the Crespi tragedy. Let me repeat that. The truth, he says, can never be known because patients keep feelings to themselves, fearing what will happen if they reveal murderous thoughts. Imagine that you are taking Zoloft and you start to have feelings that you want to murder your children, Healy said. How can you speak about it if you think that you might get locked up?
Yeah.
You know,
That's true. And I would never have thought about that, but it's hard enough, as you know, Ed, for people to say, I'm depressed, I'm suicidal, right? That's hard enough to admit to.
So
saying
true.
That you are having homicidal thoughts, that is a whole different ball game. I mean, you would really, I would think they would lock you up or at least put you somewhere and monitor you, you know, to get a right mixture of medication. And, you know, medications is trial and error. And everyone's body is different. But
that's right.
Why is, and you gave a case of which I found very interesting from Canada, David Carmichael. And the difference with the justice system and mental health system between, you know, other countries and the United States.
That,
it seems like the United
right.
States is kind of behind.
That's right. I think David has become a friend, and I feature his cautionary tale and what he's been doing around the world in two chapters called A Tale of Two Countries. And yeah, I use his story to compare and contrast what happened, you know, with the David Crespi case. So David Carmichael, like David Crespi, DC initials, was a nationally known fitness expert. And he appeared on television talking about this program that he was the director of called Participaction, which was an attempt to get Canadians to exercise more and, you know, help them have better mental and physical health. And the Canadian government cut the $5 million that funded that program. Sounds kind of familiar these days, right? They cut the program, and David became distressed and was diagnosed as being depressed. I'll try to get through this fairly quickly, but he ended up, while he was in a Paxil-induced psychosis, he strangled his beloved 11-year-old son, Ian, to death in a hotel room and called 911 the next morning, et cetera. The difference between what happened to David Carmichael and David Crespi in the Carmichael case, he was tried for first degree murder. He was found not criminally responsible for his actions. He was sent to a mental health facility in Ottawa. Brockton, I think, was the name of the facility. And he actually received pretty wonderful mental health care. His wife and his surviving daughter, who had forgiven him almost immediately, because they knew that the drugs had caused the tragedy, could visit him almost any time. They could walk on the grounds with him. And after about 2 years of treatment, he was able to go back and live with his wife and surviving daughter. And you can imagine the stigma that has haunted him ever since. So, you know, nobody's even in, you know, civilized, forgiving Canada, basically nobody has been willing to hire him, but he has found a way to get donations and to go around the world and tell his cautionary tale and try to save lives. We can talk more about one of those efforts because it involves children and adolescents, which I think is an important thing to talk about.
Oh, definitely. Yes. I can't even imagine the trauma that these families have faced. How do your other children react? Your neighbors, your community. They must be, you know, some might support, some might shun them financially. The stress of, you know, going to jail and the lack of income because, you know, they lived in a well-to-do area. He, you know, was very financially successful. And how do you go from that to being no income? It's just a lot. And then living with David Crespi, living with the fact that he killed his beautiful daughters, Tessera and Samantha.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, it takes a special type of woman, I think, a person to forgive that happened. I mean, I don't know if I could, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So I have this in the book, in the Superior Court hearing in Charlotte about the Crespi case, right toward the end, Kim Crespi, was asked to take the stand, and the defense lawyer, Jim Cooney, questioned her. And toward the end, his question was, Kim, do you still love David? And she said, okay, very haunting words, yes, of course I do. You don't stop loving somebody because they're sick.
True.
As people will find out when they read the book, Kim, in about 2015, she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, which I think probably could have been brought on by trauma, grief, etc.
Mm-hmm.
No history of Parkinson's in her family. And now she is suffering from advanced Parkinson's disease to the point where she needs 24/7 care. She can't even, I've gone to visit her, and she's lost control of her neck muscles, so there has to be a healthcare provider kind of behind her when she's in a chair to lift her head up so she can look at you eye to eye. And she's really my hero. She has never really cursed the fates. She chooses to light a candle instead of cursing the darkness. And, she's a woman of profound faith. And I will say that, I did a book signing event in Charlotte about a month or so ago, and she came to that event. It was standing room only, and she has been so lifted up by all of this. We've got to get to David and restore some of his hope.
Yes, that's what I got from reading this book. That Kim is a woman of faith, strength, grit, determination, and so heartbreaking to know that, she is suffering from severe advanced Parkinson's. How is David Crespi doing? What is going on with him at this point?
First of all, in the last 6 months or so, he's been moved to three different prisons. The second one was kind of a notoriously dangerous one where an inmate had been stabbed to death. He's in a pretty dark place. At one prison, he had kind of forged as good a life for himself as he could. He'd become an assistant to a chaplain. He had helped inmates, some of the inmates, get their GED. He was a teacher. He helped convert a few fellow inmates to Catholicism, his beloved faith. And he had a bunkmate who was one of those people that he helped convert. And the prison separated the two of them and then started bringing in more sort of young, more dangerous convicted criminals into his unit. So soon thereafter, he just started not calling his wife. They faithfully called each other at least once a week all these years, 19 years. He stopped calling her. Didn't want to see visitors. He had established kind of a pen pal relationship with like 400 different people, one of whom is General Petraeus, who wrote his act. He stopped writing all those letters. He's in a prison about 2 hours from me, and I'm going to see if I can get in. I used to be on a list of people that could visit him. I visited him with my wife and Kim twice, about a year or so after the tragedy, a year and a half later. Yeah.
And how about the children?
They are remarkable. They are all well adjusted, healthy, young adults now. And, I think they're very heartened about what's going on, but as you can imagine, and David Carmichael will tell you this, every time he has to get up and tell his story, he's re-traumatized by it. So I think all three of those young adults, they're trying to get on with their life, and of course they're constantly worried sick about their mom and their dad. And then they're trying to just look to the future as much as they can while supporting their mom and dad as best they can, and without getting re-traumatized all the time. So somehow they found a way to do that. And as far as I know, I don't think any of them has suffered from depression so far, knock on wood. So
that's remarkable. That is great. What would you like people to know from your book? What would you like them to get out of your book?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, I've got four things I'd like to leave behind, four key messages. A, when patients and their families are armed with accurate information about medications, lives can be saved. Better, more evidence-based options for treating depression are now available instead of neurotoxic pills. 3, you as a patient have a legal right to informed consent. That's a very important issue we could get into sometime. And number four, never give up hope. Never give up hope. At the end of Oprah Winfrey's hour-long episode on the Crespi tragedy, she called upon a forensic psychiatrist named Dr. Michael Wellner and, kind of asked him about depression. And he said that a key factor that characterizes severe depression is hopelessness. And he offered some tips to the audience. First, if a loved one seems to be hopeless about one specific thing, try to get them to focus on something else that might give them a reason for hope. Wellner said that this was why, as a psychiatrist, he put a good deal of stock in faith and spirituality. They offer, quote, a clear and unobstructed pathway to hope, he said. Second, never allow a depressed person to isolate. And don't be hurt if they try to shut you out. Try to find someone else they can connect with. Finally, Wellner said that perhaps the key lesson he wanted to impart, one that you may not hear from anywhere else, is do not rely upon medicine. Doctors will only do so much. You may set yourself up for disappointment.
Wow, that is really powerful and strong. I know, Ed, I barely scratched the surface with your book. Don't want to give the whole book away either. I want people to buy it.
True.
Where can people purchase your book, Medication, Mental Illness, and Murder, What Really Killed the Crespi Twins?
Thanks for asking. I would advise that you go to my website, edwardleejones.com. That's edwardleejones.com. And there's a tab there that says buy the book, and there's four different links to various online places where you can buy the book. Of course, Amazon, there's Barnes & Noble, there's my publisher, Roman and Littlefield, and one other that I forget, but whatever method is best for you.
And can people connect with you on your website?
They can. They can. Yeah, there's a form that that's on there. And, yeah, my son is kind of monitoring that. But, yeah, if you fill that form out and give me your contact information, I will get back to you.
Well, Edward L. Jones III, I can't thank you enough. If you were standing in front of me, I'd give you a hug.
back at you.
I think it is so brave of you to not only write this book with a tough subject matter that must be addressed, but for you yourself to admit to the world that you did have a depression. That's not easy to say. And
right.
I tell people, I tell my audience all the time, you know, seek support. I still see a psychologist. I'm not ashamed to say it, because I feel if they hear me, maybe they'll say, oh, if Betsy goes, then I'll go. She's not ashamed of going. Folks, if you need support, it's not a sign of weakness. Matter of fact, it's a sign of strength. I can't repeat it enough to say I need help. And it's okay to need help. And folks, don't judge others. Don't judge others that they take medication or they are seeking support, because you never know what life is going to throw at you. Need to see someone, or you might need to take medication. You don't know what life has in store for you. I'm glad I don't suffer from depression anymore. I read a book back in the 70s by Tim LaHaye. He's I don't know if he was a Christian psychologist. I don't even remember, but he believed that depression was anger turned inward, which was interesting. Excuse me.
Exactly.
But I would love to have you on again, Ed. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, but anytime, because we could talk about medication. We could talk about so many things and your book.
Yeah.
Folks, I would run and get this book. It is not depressing as you might think that it sounds. It's a book of hope. It will open your eyes to medications. It will open your eyes and your mind to think, to question your doctor if you are on medication and if you have side effects, to question your doctor. Don't be afraid to speak up. We must speak up. I had to speak up for my husband when he was getting side effects. Of course, they didn't believe me, but I have a big mouth, so I did prove my point. I'm not afraid to cause waves. I'll cause a tsunami if I have to get my point across. And I just really thank you, Edward L. Jones III, for coming on my show and just writing this awesome book. This is your first book. What are you? Do you have a book in mind for the next one?
Not yet. I'm toying with a screenplay or two. I'm hoping. Kind of one of my next steps is I'm hoping that we could convince a producer somewhere to do a Netflix-style docuseries based on this book. I think that would be really powerful.
Oh, absolutely. I hope that comes through for you. Absolutely. And if by any chance you let me know, and you can come on my show and promote it. Whatever you do, Ed, you want to come back on my show and promote whatever you're doing, screenplay, you just let me know, because I would be more than happy to promote whatever you do.
I would love to do that.
I just, you know, want to say I best wishes. I hope this book becomes an international bestseller. I want the world to know about David Crespi and his family and what they went through. And it's a tragedy because it could have been prevented if they knew about side effects. And really, I hope that's changed. And you're right. Ask about the side effects. Get the informed consent. You can always ask your pharmacy. It always comes in with the medication. Read it.
Yeah.
And, you know, read the side effects. And, you know, we have to be our own advocates. That's it. I talk about that all the time. Educate yourself and be an advocate for yourself and your family. You don't have to have a big mouth like me to tell them and tell them the world. But you can do what you do in your own corner with for your own family and yourself. And it's so important. And I really would be honored to have you on again. There's a multitude we could discuss. Thank you again, Edward, for coming on. And all the information, folks, about the book and Edward L. Jones III will be in the blog that Jeannie White, who's the station manager, writes. And thank Jeannie. And I want to thank Lumen Caldwell, who's CEO, makes this all possible, Pastor World Talk Radio Network. I want to thank Alyssa Warren, who is president of Alyssa Warren PR, who introduced me to this book and to Edward Jones, phenomenal PR person. Alyssa is the best in her field as far as I'm concerned. And so if you're looking for a publicist, I'm going to have Alyssa's information in the blog also. So I'm going to shout out to Alyssa because a lot of her clients are a big part of Chatting with Betsy. And I'm ever so grateful. And folks, I just want to say this. Don't judge people of what they're going through. I know I said it before. You are not alone. There are resources out there. That's what I do my show for. I want people to know about resources for you to have a better life. If you are in a crisis, call 988 in the United States. Seek your primary care physician for mental health references in your area. And let's stop the stigma of mental health. I'm glad it's less stigmatized now than it was in the 70s. And I'm glad about that, but we need to change our way of thinking. And please, for the love of all that is God, please stop telling people to be strong. It doesn't help, folks. It's hurtful, actually. Mm-hmm. It's actually hurtful. It's not helpful. Please stop saying that. You know what you should say instead? I'm going to tell you. Say, I'm here for you. How can I help you? Or just listen. Just be a shoulder or an ear. That's what people need. And, you know, and to give them hope. And I want to thank everyone for listening. If you don't already subscribe to Chatting with Betsy, it is for free to subscribe to on Spotify, Spreaker, and Amazon Music, to name just a few. And as I always say at the end of my show, in a world where you can be anything, please be kind and shine your light bright, because we need it now more than ever before. This is Betsy Wurzel, your host of Chatting with Betsy on Pastor World Talk Radio Network. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye now.